Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered ChumbaCasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby. Mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa. Take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to ChumbaCasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
This is the Ridiculous Ashes podcast. I'm Dan Lipke. With me is Alex Bowden.
Hello.
This is a special bonus edition of the Ridiculous Ashes podcast in which we're going to shine a ridiculous spotlight on one of the players who featured prominently in our most recent series, and that was, of course, the 2013-14 Ashes. And that player is, of course, Michael Clarke.
Yeah, the moment that really seemed to sort of sum up that series was Michael Clarke telling James Anderson to get ready for a broken fucking arm when England were 100 million miles from even getting close to victory and Austria were about to thrash them. He cropped up a few times, but we felt like he was a player we wanted to talk about a bit more. He's a guy I never really got to grips with, and I never really, like, massively... He's never my favourite player, which is perfectly normal. I'm English. But it seemed pretty obvious that plenty of Aussies didn't much like him either, which is not normal. And several of the Aussies who didn't like him were his teammates, which is even more striking. So it raises a lot of questions. So we're going to try and work him out. And to help us with that, we've called in an expert. We've got Adam Collins. We call him the final words, Adam Collins, but you'll see him pretty much everywhere these days. Adam is a particularly good choice because he wrote Wisden's retirement piece on Clarke and also a hate to love piece, which I think is kind of crucial. So, you're our expert, Adam. You okay with that?
What a flattering way to be brought into the show, fellas. Being the expert on Michael Clarke, I'm not sure whether I'm necessarily qualified, but it is true to say that I've spent a lot of time thinking about Michael Clarke. From the very start of his career, I have these memories of him playing his first Boxing Day Test match, which would have been 2004, 2005. And that was the era when Brad Hodge was being routinely overlooked for the Australian team. Victorian, I'm from Melbourne, and Michael Clarke, who obviously earned a chance to play for Australia, but nevertheless, I was bellowing from the top of the southern stand that Clarke would rather be at the Boxing Day sales than the Boxing Day tests, and thought I was all very funny, really, not realising how immature and juvenile that kind of sledge was, and how ironic the fact that I'd been at the Boxing Day sales that morning before coming into the cricket later in the morning. So, yeah, and that's where it started for me through the 2005 Ashes series, really, being a heavy critic of his, growing to respect him. I remember writing a piece when he played his 100th test match during the 13-14 Ashes and documented what an extraordinary purple patch he'd been on since becoming test captain. And really, that's the bit when it goes the other way, from the third test of the 13-14 Ashes through to the end of his career at the Oval in 2015. It's quite a considerable lull, with the exception of two spectacular innings, one against South Africa in Cape Town and one against India in Adelaide after Philip Hughes died. But with the exception of that, he really did struggle. And that was most of the time that I was covering his Australian team when I became a cricket journalist full time. So, yeah, I feel across those 10 or 12 years, whatever it worked out to be, that I had a pretty interesting time documenting his career, especially at the end. But yeah, as a fan first and a journalist second, and now as your expert, happy to be here.
World authority, Michael Clark. Right, so this is what we're going to do. It's not radically dissimilar from what we normally do. We're gonna nominate two ridiculous moments from Clark's career each. Hopefully we'll get a nice spread of good, bad and weird moments, but we'll see. And we'll discuss each one. And then we're going to try and rank them to establish our gold, silver, bronze of Clark ridiculousness. And at that point, we'll have worked them out and resolved everything, and everything will be fine.
That's good. All right. So you got the first?
Yeah, I'll go first. I'm kind of the outsider, so I'm kind of the viewing from the outside and trying to work him out. So I'm taking some of the more obvious moments, if that's all right. And the first thing that came to mind for me was Simon Kasich grabbing him by the throat. Which, these are the kind of things which bubble up and are sort of big enough news that we hear about them in England, and we're kind of interested in them in England as well. So the situation here was, and it's one of those where I think you kind of get a slightly different story depending on who you ask. I don't know if you guys can add anything to this in a minute, but this is the version that I've got in my head. So Australia had beaten South Africa at the SCG in 2009. Michael Clark wanted to sing the team song, and it's generally assumed that he was pressuring everyone to sing it a bit earlier so he could piss off and go and do something else. However, only the custodian of the song, the official custodian of the song, which at this time was Mike Hussey, can decide when it's sung, I believe. Which I have to say is my favourite part of the whole story, the fact that Australia has an official custodian of the song. I love that.
I mean, that's just common sense, surely, Alec. I do have a list of the custodians here. It apparently started with Rod Marsh, then it went to Alan Border, who passed it on to David Boone, because there is a principle, and this is perfectly logical, as I'm sure you can understand, that a captain should not be the song custodian. That would make no sense.
It's a conflict of interest, isn't
exactly.
It?
So David Boone became the song custodian. He passed it to Ian Healy, who passed it to Ricky Ponting. And obviously when Ricky Ponting became captain, he passed it to Justin Langer, who passed it to Michael Hussey, who eventually passed it, a little bit controversially, to Nathan Lyon, who was by no means a fixture in the side at that time. Nevertheless, all these players became song custodian just based on the sheer quality of their singing voices, I'm sure.
They never came up against what would have happened if Nathan Lyon had have been, because Nathan Lyon, of course, was custodian not long before he was dropped from the Australian team in England in the start of the 2013 Ashes. If Australia had have won at Nottingham or Lords, who would have led the song? It's one of the great unanswered questions.
Is there not a vice custodian? They don't like
Yeah, well, it's funny you ask that. There was a version of this did happen when Matthew Wade was the custodian of the song for the one day team, and then Matthew Wade lost his spot and they had to find a fix, because they only sing the song at the end of a one day series, not a one day win. But anyway, yes, there's the internal politics of the song. The you fucking beauty! Second, same as the first. Woo!
So the situation here was, Clark reckoned that Simon Kasich and Mike Hussey were enjoying, sort of reveling in delaying him and winding him up. So he lost it and he had a go at Simon Kasich, and Kasich grabbed him by the throat. And that's kind of, I think that's most of that's widely accepted. As a bit of a postscript to that, though, Kasich never actually played a test under Clark's captaincy. And I think he still feels that's relevant or pertinent.
It probably didn't help, did it?
No, it didn't. To be honest, and I'm saying, like, this is my nomination, Simon Kasich grabbing Clark by the throat, but this is one of quite a few feuds. I don't know if you guys have any favourite Michael Clark feuds.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose I'd add to the Kasich one by saying that, I mean, this dragged out over a number of years, didn't it? And Dan Breding's book, Whitewash to Whitewash, did a good job of articulating the backstory, which you summed up there, Alex. But also when Simon joined the media, in his first season on radio, I was working with him on the ABC, and he told the story in great depth because, like, why not? He was outside of the system at that point. It's a good tale, and so it went. And I think the punchline for him is that when he held him up, Clark against the wall, he got was it fake tan or bronzer on his hand? I mean, of course, that's just a throwaway line. It's just a joke. I guess it's one of those sportsman's night lines he would use. But it got a whole other rewrite in that. And he was absolutely furious. I can tell you from at the time I was working in federal politics, and when the other Steve Smith, who was the foreign minister at the time, got asked about, he might have been defence minister actually, but still a senior cabinet minister, was asked about Kasich being omitted from the contract list. produced, he went on television and went fucking wild, and it was outstanding defending Cat's honour because, of course, it wasn't just that Kadich was left out of the team. He was exiled entirely as Clark took over as captain. So, yeah, it was an ongoing feud, and I'm not sure whether they've patched it up in any meaningful way. I suspect they probably haven't, given that Clark doesn't seem to really have any work around the Australian cricket media now. But yeah, it did. It certainly did give. It was a lightning rod for those who wanted to give Clark a whack as he was sort of starting his captaincy career.
Yeah, as you mentioned, there were multiple feuds. I think this one kind of spilled over theoretically into a bit of a hussy feud, there may not have actually been a hussy feud. I find Mike Hussey to be probably the most improbable person on earth that you could have a feud with. He seems like a thoroughly pleasant person. So if there was a feud there, I think that was pretty limited. But the other feuds that I've kind of got listed here, mostly just from memory, were you had one with Andrew Symonds, Shane Watson, and a brief one with Darren Lehman towards the end of Clark's career. So they're probably the other major three feuds that we could probably delve into a little bit further.
Yeah, a good collection there. I suppose there might be a little bit of my enemy's enemy is my friend there with some of them, like where you might fall in the different camps. But yeah, when Shane Watson got the chance to be Australia's captain in India in 2013 for one test match, that was on account of the fact that Clark was injured after Watson had been sent home through the homework gate for Argo. So interesting how they did that little do-si-do at the time when the team was getting pumped in 2013, losing 4-0 in India.
Yeah, I mean, that was around the time that Clark allegedly called Watto a cancer on the team.
Yes.
He later denied those exact words. There was a 60 Minutes interview where he says he didn't say he was a cancer on the team. He said that there was a group of players, including Shane Watson, who were like a tumour, and if they didn't fix it, it was going to turn into a cancer. So that's very different, isn't it? That's much more understandable. And then, of course, the Andrew Symonds one, they were originally good mates, and then that kind of all fell to pieces as Symonds' discipline issues kind of became misaligned, let's say, with Clark's desire to become a part of the leadership group. So when Symonds didn't show up to a team meeting for an ODI against Bangladesh, Clark had to sack him, and that kind of ended that friendship.
The weirdest to me is what preceded it, that Andrew Symonds and Michael Clark were great mates. That's the thing that I can't wrap my head around. The feud, I kind of like, well, yeah, I can see how they might rub each other the wrong way. The bit before that, where they're not feuding, that's the bit I don't really understand.
Yeah, they don't seem very likely friends.
No, in a way not, but I suppose at the time when Clark was coming into the team, you know, under Warne's wing, the guys who really like to go out and give it what for. Was Clark out that night in Cardiff in 2005? I don't know. I might be impugning him here, but I suspect he probably was. That was certainly the time when he would have been out and about doing his thing, playing his shots, giving it his best. But yeah, it reminds me of that that old that Pakistani meme where it's like, no longer my best friend, you know, across the line through Andrew Symonds, and you know, my best friend is now, and you can fill in the blanks there as to who Clark's best friend might have become when Symonds hit the wall for him and left the Australian cricket team.
Yep.
Andrew Symonds hit Rahul Dravid, did you say? That's news. Breaking.
and of course, there's the Darren Lehman feud. This was, as I mentioned, quite late. This was Clark got annoyed. There was a ODI series against Zimbabwe that Australia somehow managed to lose. And Clark basically was of the opinion that the middle order batsman Steve Smith should have been picked for the spin-friendly wicket in Harare. That was the quote. You know, fair call probably from Clark. I would generally pick middle order batsman Steve Smith, regardless of whether it's spin friendly wickets or not. But anyway, Darren Lehman didn't like the idea that Clark had vented his frustrations in public. So there was a little bit of a back and forth between those two, which kind of threatened to become something more after Clark got injured. And then he wanted to come back from his injury to play against India through grade cricket. And Darren Lehman and the selectors were saying, no, you've got to, you know, come back through first class cricket. And this was all just about to come to, you know, come to a head when Philip Hughes was killed, and everybody kind of said, oh shit, we've been carrying on like pork chops, and in the greater scheme of things, it's probably not that big a deal.
Yeah, I mean, it's often been said that could have been the day that Michael Clark was jettisoned from the Australian cricket team.
Yeah.
An extraordinary, horrible, dreadful day in every possible way. But the fact that, yes, Clark had made his intentions very clear. It was a test of strength against the administrators and the coaching staff. Remember, he played that game of grade cricket where the opposing team elected to declare it 14 for no loss or something like that in order to let Clark get a bat. He was able to play, if I recall correctly, one day of a two-day game.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I think it was the case that the opposition won the toss and did bat, but then they realised they should declare and allow Clark to bat in order to give him a hit in the absence of playing. I think it was a tour game against India. Clark didn't want to play the tour game. So like it would have been the Cricket Australia 11 or something like that against India. Of course, that game never went ahead. But nevertheless, there was this push and pull. I suppose, as you rightly say, Dan, it was pushed onto the back burner for all the right reasons when cricket came together after Philip Hughes's passing.
All right, my first nomination kind of follows on a little bit from this feuding talk, because I've got Michael Clark throwing a ball into Shane Watson. And this is a little bit of a Watson and Clark slapstick. We go all the way back to 2010, where Australia and Sri Lanka are playing a white ball series just before the 2010-11 Ashes. So Sri Lanka have already won the Seoul T20 in the first ODI, and in the second ODI, we've got Shane Watson bowling to Sangakkara. Sangakkara inside edges it past the stumps, and Brad Haddin, as the wicketkeeper, moves and grabs the ball. And Upal Tharanga, he's charging down the pitch for a single, which Sangakkara is having absolutely none of that. He turns his back on him, so Tharanga turns around and half-heartedly trots back towards the non-striker's end. Just as Haddin loops this big loopy throw, it kind of floats over Watson's head, but Clark has dashed in from cover to just behind the stumps at the non-striker's end. He picks up the ball and pings it with all his might at the stumps. And it's a perfect throw. It's dead straight. Would hit the stumps, halfway up middle stump. But alas, poor old Shane Watson, he'd kind of tried to catch Haddin's lob throw and ended up finding himself in between Clark and the stumps. So as Clark's pinging the ball at the stumps, he kind of panics and tries to move out of the way, only to move directly into the line of fire. And he takes the ball in the right knee, and every single person on Twitter proceeds to joke about Watto's superhuman ability to get his legs in front of stumps. And this is where Ian Healy comes up with a little bit of wordplay on commentary. He points out that Clark's throw is going to hit the middle of the medial cartilage, which is pretty good for Ian Healy. And obviously, Tharanga makes his ground. Clark kind of tries to stifle a laugh at the incident. Watto trudges back to the bowling crease. Richie Benno on commentary then declares it to be a nonsense day all round. Sri Lanka win the match, the series, and it's just one of the all-time great comedy moments. I love this moment. It's one of my favourite ones on YouTube. I watch it regularly.
I don't know if it really gives in how much insight it gives into either man's character, but it feels like a very pure example of each person's personality. Like Clark, he threw unnecessarily hard given the batsman had given up and was at the other end, but he very visibly thought it was pretty funny that he'd hit Shane Watson. Watson was like almost heartbroken that he'd been hit and like upset that people were laughing at him being hit. You could see him like not sulking, but you felt like it was overwhelming him. And then Clark seems to find it funny that Watson's upset about it as well. And I don't know if he comes out of it all that well. It's quite a tense moment.
It is. Maybe that's the birthplace of the feud. Who can say?
Are we moving on then? Is Adam's first nomination?
Sure. I think that, it's hard to look at ridiculous Clark moments without looking at his two extraordinary performances with the ball, one match winning, one not. So the 6 for 9, his first wicket in Test cricket contributed to a 6-wicket haul in the space of seemingly moments in that crazy Mumbai Test. I mean, it was the case that India were behind in the Test match after Australia had bowled them out on the first day, but a low scoring scrap on a dust bowl. And then all hell breaks loose. I love the commentary as well. It's Dean Jones at his best when he takes his fifth wicket. It's like, whoa, Michael Clark's got a Michelle Pfeiffer. At one stage, one of the host broadcasters says that he will treasure the Pfeiffer more than he will his Test 100 on debut, which I think is one of the most thick things I've ever fucking heard. I mean, you know, Clark, making 100 at the first time of asking in Test cricket, calling for the baggy green, as I'm sure you both remember.
Yep.
Even though seamers were bowling at him, he needed to be wearing and kissing that baggy green, tips in the hair, as if it were foretold, you know what I'm saying? Rudy Kirtson contributed to the Pfeiffer. the 6 for 9 with a couple of decisions that could have gone either way. But yeah, I mean, it was a reminder that when he first arrived on the scene, that Clark was seen as a very useful spin option. Not, I mean, I would go as far to say more than a part-time spinner.
Yep.
And because of that 6 for 9, it was the reputation he maintained for a number of years. And yeah, the second performance there is when he takes 3 wickets in 5 balls to finish that test at Sydney in 2008, which still beggars belief when you consider all the circumstances of that week, and that moved Australia to 16 test victories in a row. But yeah, poor old Ishant Sharma walking out with 2 right gloves and the mess of that fallout, the monkey gate and all the rest, but yeah, at the end, Clark being instrumental to the victory. And then in some respects, the fact that Clark bowls quite a lot in the following, let's call it the following 12 months. You look back through his career, between that win in Sydney in 2008, and you press fast forward for the next, say, 12 months, he does an awful lot of bowling. And then he can't do much of it after about 2008 because his back's stuffed. So he seldom gets a chance to turn the arm over. Takes a fifer in Dominica in 2012, but really that's it. He goes entire years on occasion without bowling and seldom bowled himself when he was captain either. So, yeah, it was I suppose, something that we should have treasured for what it was rather than expecting it to be a routine thing.
Yeah, I think I find that the 2008 over, like, just that's just one of the most astonishing things I've ever seen. There were 2 scheduled overs to go in the match. They might have had time to sneak a couple more in, but realistically, the test was gone. India was 7 wickets yeah, down. They were going to get the draw, and then Clark just came on, went bang bang, first 2 balls, and then, as you mentioned, Ishant Sharma comes out with 2 right gloves, conveniently wasting a little bit of time as well, and then but to no avail because 3 balls later he's gone as well. It was just an astonishing over. I remember watching it on TV, and I couldn't believe it. It was amazing.
That probably answers my question as to why he was bowling. I don't mean because he wasn't a good bowler, because at that point, like you say, he was considered a handy bowler, but I noticed it was only his second over of the innings.
Yeah,
and it was the penultimate over of the match, and you'd kind of think that they were, like, in my head I was thinking, well, you'd be pressing for the win, why have you got someone like a part-time bowler bowling only second over in the penultimate over of the match? But yeah, I guess they just thought the match was gone, so they were just kind of going through the motions, and then he just happened to win the match.
there was a lot of criticism of Ricky Ponting for declaring too late, and that they were trying to equal Steve Waugh's team's record of 16 wins in a row, and they thought they'd left it too late. There was a lot of criticism of Ricky Ponting, and I also remember distinctly after Clark kind of just pulled this one out of his butt that there was a lot of we told you we declared perfectly, we knew what we were doing all along, as they were running around celebrating.
What a hindsight corner.
Hindsight corner.
Yeah, exactly. And this was also the match. So there'd been a lot of controversy in the match. India were not at all happy with anything that was going on here. There'd been edges that weren't given out by the umpires, and the Australians hadn't walked. Michael Clark himself edged directly to Anil Kumble at slip when he was batting and didn't walk. It wasn't even Stuart Broad style deflected off the keeper's gloves. He edged it straight to slip, and they just waited for the umpire to give him out.
Well, Ishant Sharma as well, he did the same thing.
Yes, tell.
He was just like hanging around, like, I don't know what the doubt was. He just edged it to slip. Match is over.
But it was after this match, Peter Roebuck wrote this scathing article that basically said Ricky Ponting should be sacked. The Australian behaviour, like I think he called them dogs, like wild dogs or something. It was an unpleasant end to a test, which was a shame because it was a miraculous piece of bowling from Michael Clark.
My favourite part of it, just to go back to the actual over itself, was Ishant Sharma with the 2 right gloves. But I'm a big fan of, like, from the middle sign language when the batsman needs something, and this was a particularly fine one because he had 2 gloves and he had to sign, like, mime, yes, I've got 2 gloves and I know that's the right number of gloves, but I could do with the left, which is a great thing to try and express from, like, 100 yards away with just your hands. And after that 3 for, I checked, Clark had 9 wickets against India at 5.11.
Wow.
Pretty good record.
Yeah, that's fantastic.
My next one is, again, another one that I think is like a big one in the minds of, like, well, some England fans. And it's not really cricket-related, but it's Icene Alistair Cook. It's Michael Clarke announcing England's team for the first test of the 2014 Ashes in what we presume was like a comedy bit, but it's just, it was a weird bit that he did in a press conference. So he started by saying, and that's the first thing that he started by saying, I seen Alistair Cook, which was peculiar. I seen Alistair Cook yesterday at Remembrance Day ceremony in Sydney. Unfortunately enough, he gave me their team as well for the first test match. And then he announces what he says is going to be England's team. And then he contradicts his own made-up story, referring to Cook, and says, now he doesn't exactly know that team yet, even though, like, Cook supposedly told it to him. That's how he knows it. Now, he doesn't know the team yet, but I know that's the 11. And at one point, he refers to Darren Layman and says he's just left the building. And I've, like, this to me, like, that's the most interesting bit to me, because in my, like, I feel like this is an insight into what happens, because I can't really work out what's going on in his head with this. I feel like he floated this idea to do this naming of England team to Layman, and Layman just said it was a terrible idea. And then Clark just went and did it anyway. And Layman just, like, saw him starting to do it and just walked out and just gave up on him. But yeah, Clark was right, wasn't he? He got the team right.
Yeah,
Anderson and Tremblett the wrong way around, but he named the right team. But what interests me about this is it's another aspect of, like, Michael Clark's character that I never really got, because he's quite an intense character. He's like a real fast talker, and he seems very serious most of the time. But then every now and again, he's prone to doing these sort of zany things, like. And you know, zany's not really like in comedy. It's always a thing you kind of want to steer away from, I think, zaniness. He doesn't strike me as someone who's very relaxing to be around. He's either, like, being, like, consciously zany, or he's being very fast-talking, intense, and, like, he's, I don't know, he seems like a tough person to be around.
Yeah, I mean, as a basis for a skit, the whole idea of, you know, poning England by naming their side before they did, it's not really a strong enough comedy premise, I would have thought, for a skit, but... If you're going to go with it, do a few more drafts, Michael. This was not good. This from like the grammatically flawed opening line to the excruciating end 63 seconds later, it's just cringe comedy.
He's very confident in it. It's not like he got halfway through and realised, oh, this is totally unravelling, I'm contradicting myself, I said I seen Alistair Cook. He just kind of, like, ploughs on, and he's very comfortable with all of that.
It's very in keeping, isn't it? Because, I mean, you know, you reach a certain level of, and this is kind of tapping into the great cricketer podcast spirits, but if you're such an alpha male, you don't do comedy, you do put downs.
Yeah.
You don't do laughs for response, you do abuse for recognition. And I think this almost taps into that. It's Clark trying to alpha, as it were, the England tourist, more than it is him trying to do a bit. It's him trying to show his superiority to them, his inherent superiority to them. So I think that's what we're thinking of Clark. Remember the old cricket show bit that they did? They made about him during the 2002-03 Ashes, I think it would have been. So just after he was overlooked to replace Mark Waugh in the team, Darren Layman was given the chance at number six. The cricket show went out and did a spot with Clark where it's when he had his BMW, which would have been, I suppose, his first car. And sure, he was a player on the make. He made a number of centuries for New South Wales by that point. But he's like 20 or 21. And the whole bit was about sort of asserting himself as the next big thing. And yeah, it translated through to the clothes he was wearing, the earring, the car, the whole bit, right? And yeah, I think sometimes you need to put yourself in the shoes of that. He's not looking for the validation of people like us from a human perspective. He's looking to belittle people and to assert where he sits in the pecking order. And whether he realises it or not, he's preconditioned to it, because that's all he's ever known.
I'm glad he wasn't trying to sell us on comedy. You're almost certainly right, Adam. I hadn't thought of it that way, but yes, that's an excellent point. Moving on to my next nomination, we've got... I'm going to nominate Michael Clarke's century against South Africa in 2011. So he'd been given the captaincy earlier in the year. This is after Australia had lost the Ashes. Ricky Ponting had stepped down, but crucially, Ponting had remained in the side, which in itself was, like, really unusual, because Australian captains, you know, tended to stay captains until they retired. If they were going to be sacked as captain, they were going to be sacked from the side, and that was just how Australia pretty much done things, you know, ever since Kim Hughes, basically. But Ricky Ponting wanted to bat on, but he was no longer viable as captain. So Michael Clarke had become captain. And going into that first test in Cape Town, he had a 1-1 record. He'd lost to England in the final test of that Ashes series, but he'd beaten Sri Lanka in one test and then drawn two others. And so in Cape Town, Australia batted first. Clarke came to the crease at the fall of Ponting. The score was 3 for 40. And he then went on to score 151 out of a total of 284, which is not quite in Bannerman territory. It's only 53%, but it's still, you know, pretty impressive as a captain. He was also the last man out. And then Australia followed that up by bowling out South Africa for, you know, 96. They lost 9 for 47 with Shane Watson, 5 for 17, the pick of the bowlers. And at that point, everything was pretty much coming up Michael Clarke in this first test in South Africa. And then Australia didn't lose 9 for 47. They lost 10 for 47. They were all out for 47. Clarke made 2. And at one point, they were 9 for 21 and at very grave risk of making the lowest ever test score. But then Nathan Lyon and Peter Siddle added 26 for the final wicket. It wasn't enough, of course. South Africa cruised to a win. But this is I feel like this is perfect Michael Clarke territory. Like he can do all these magnificent things, but still crazy bad things can go on around him as well. I very much enjoyed this century.
I think that this, alongside the 2014 epic, are the two sort of great Clarke masterpieces. Perhaps you could throw in the century at Adelaide. After Philip Hughes passed away later in 2014. But for all the reasons you detailed there, and then in 2014, what he had to get through with Mornay Morkel literally breaking his shoulder early in the innings in one of the most fierce interrogations we've ever seen from a fast bowler on a fast pitch around the wicket the whole bit. This was the period of his career, 2011, just when he starts to take off and he's the number one player in the world. Of course, there's the year with the four double centuries that follows in 2012, and he's untouchable. And I think it kind of starts here at Cape Town. So not deep into his captaincy career, really, is it? He's only taken the reins in Sri Lanka formally, full-time, earlier that year. And if you want to cycle back to January of 2011, I was at that test match where he stood in as captain for Ricky Ponting. And I sincerely, he was booed onto the SCG, not by everybody, not by a majority of people, but there were a significant minority of people who were booing Michael Clarke under his own home ground when captaining Australia for the first time. Such were the depths that he'd plumbed in public opinion through 2011. Perhaps more relevant to the conversation, which was the dip he'd gone on after that century. He obviously returns to Sydney to break up with his fiancée, makes a century upon getting to New Zealand. But then after that, between that point in time and taking over as Australian captain temporarily in early 2011, his average was like 29. And there was a view that how is this guy captaining Australia when he shouldn't be in the team, which was a strong building view around the cricket fraternity. So the fact that within 12 months, within 10 months of being appointed as full-time captain, he's playing in innings the likes of what he did in Cape Town, albeit in a losing cause. And then they go and win the following week in Johannesburg, it must be remembered too.
That was Pat Cummins' first test. And then
it was.
And
it was.
Then Pat Cummins was injured for the rest of Michael Clarke's captaincy.
Well, that's right. But you look at the debuts in quick succession. So Cummins, Stark and Pattinson all debut in the space of two test matches, which helps Clarke rejuvenate his bowling lineup. And we all know what happens in 13-14 when he gets Johnson back to his best alongside Ryan Harris. But yeah, that is a big turning point. It's an inflection point on the Clarke story, what he's able to do in Cape Town and then what he does for the next two and a half years.
Yeah, just going through those 2012 double centuries, there was 329 not out, 210 against India at the beginning of the year, then 259 not out and 230 against South Africa at the end of the year. You could do nothing else in the year and still go, oh, that's a pretty good year. That's an amazing run.
That purple patch, it doesn't feel like a thing people really necessarily celebrate that much. That's the kind of thing I don't know if it's me just like actively avoiding reading articles about Michael Clarke or anything, but it doesn't feel like a thing that crops up in the way that people always sort of reminisce about the great Ricky Ponting and things. It feels like it just doesn't happen for Michael Clarke, and that year was just insane.
Yeah, I think that's right. I feel as if that's I mean, to be honest, I feel like I almost forgot that. There are times when I'm writing a book or an article or something. When I was writing my book on the 50 greatest Australian cricketers last year, available in all good bookshops, I was going through the Australian captains because I figured pretty much all of those would have to get there. And for a brief second, I forgot Michael Clarke existed. I went straight from Ponting to Smith, and then I was just like, no, that's all right. There's Michael Clarke. There is something as ridiculous as he is, as we've covered here. There is something strangely forgettable about him, which I can't quite put my finger on.
Yeah, I mean, but you're right, though. It couldn't have been. I mean, it was such a deep purple patch. He first 30 test matches as permanent captain, he made 12 centuries. I mean, that's a strike rate of one ton in every sort of 2.5 tests. I mean, that's, 40%, whatever it is.
Yep.
You've got Bradman, who's the outlier, who made a century in 56% of his test matches.
Yeah, we don't count Bradman. 40%.
Yeah, Bradman, you can't really use in these comparisons. But then you go through it. I mean, you've got, Walcott and Weeks for 34% and 31%, respectively. So you're kind of, I know it's a period in isolation, but as it is, it was as good as almost anyone. Really, the only person that goes and tops that is when Steve Smith gets on his roll that begins at level in 2013 and runs through until, well, depends how you want to define it, but let's say Manchester 2019, if you want. There's a couple of lulls in there, but for the most part, yep, he's the only other player that gets up towards that sort of 40% mark across an extended stretch of time.
All right. So that's Michael Clarke's entry. Over to you for your second nomination, Adam.
Okay. My second nomination, we're going to – okay, well, let's go to 2015. So 2015 was the time when I went full-time on the beat, went to the Caribbean with the Australian team, and then the Ashes thereafter, which was Clarke's farewell. I wouldn't call it a farewell because it was far from a victory lap. It was hardly Bradman 48, if you know what I'm trying to say,
yep,
or anything close to it. So he'd obviously been to England in 2005, 2009, and 2013 as a three-time loser, and then would leave as a four-time loser, which he was gutted about. Obviously, was part of the two whitewashes in between. But I suppose the not winning in England thing really cut deep. And yeah, I arrived at a strange time because I think that Clark's written about this, hasn't he? That he spent 3 weeks in the Caribbean, not leaving his hotel room, just ordering room service, and not wanting to be part of anything. Such were the emotions still swirling with him, only after the World Cup starting to process the passing of Phil Hughes, and that's when it all hit him, when he was on tour away from everybody. So I didn't really see much of him in the Caribbean, with the exception of an interview that I did with him for the ABC before the first test match, and he was monosyllabic. He just did not want to give me anything beyond two sort of three-word answers, which made it a complete unusable debacle. And for a nervous, brand spanking new freelancer, I was absolutely petrified at what I had turned out. But it wasn't me, it was him. He just didn't want to play ball. And that was reflected of the way that he sort of went through the England part of the tour as well. I remember we did a press conference with him with the written press one afternoon, and it was much the same. He'd made his mind up that we were against him or some version of that, and he'd reached the end of his tether when it came to engaging with the media. So, but no, through that series on the field, I mean, there were moments, there were brief glimpses of the guy we used to know, but it was pretty clear that he was finished as an international player. And that all focused in on the Trent Bridge test match when they're all out for what was it? All out
60.
For 60. Yep. All out for 60. I should know. I was sitting in the front row of the press box, but yep. Clark saying that his attitude towards playing Stuart Broad or playing any fast bowler in form like that was to simply swing as hard as he could. And that always stuck with me. His attitude to playing, a guy who's bowling a worldly spell in the most favourable conditions possible, his view was the only way he could or anyone could get through that was by swinging harder and harder and harder. And it just like bewildered me at the time because it broke with all convention, didn't it? That he'd be able to get out of that. And in the end, he was caught, I think, at second slip, swinging as hard as he possibly could in keeping with what he'd said. So, it was a fairly sad end. We got wind of the fact that he was going to retire that morning. I think Ben Horne broke the story, and then he made the announcement upon them losing that test, and that was that. Apart from when he briefly signalled after sandpaper, maybe this should have been my nomination in hindsight, after the sandpaper, I mean, he said that he would be available to serve again as captain if called upon. Country in the great game of cricket, if given the armband again. But thankfully, that never came to that, and they let him get on with doing whatever it is that he's doing, commentating in India and all the rest of it. So, but no, that 2015, the end of it, it was abrupt, because you go back to 2013 and that purple patch he was in the middle of, it didn't feel like it was ever going to end. You know, they win the Ashes 5-0. They beat South Africa in South Africa. They win a World Cup with Clark, you know, walking out triumphant 70-odd in that final. Whether he should have been in the team or otherwise, the fact that he got through the fitness test, got back into the team and was more or less there at the end was validation of his one-day career coming to the perfect end on home soil. Then it was kind of like one more tour, one more visit to England. And, yeah, he just couldn't get it done. So, yeah, a fairly sad demise to his on-field career at Ashes loser in England for the fourth time. And his average actually dropped below 50 in that final test, I reckon, or it might have been in the previous test match. It had been above 50 for a number of years, and it finished with a 4 in front of it and not in 5 in front of it because of that dip at the very end, which I'm sure is something that pisses him off now when, you know, Dan, you're writing about the greatest Australian players or whatever. Almost all of them would have a 5 in front of their average, except for Clark, which is like 49.9 or something like that.
I'd forgotten that he offered to come back. Maybe that's why he wanted to come back after the sandpaper gay thing, to, you know, try and nudge it up to 50. And of course, in doing so, he's following in the great tradition of, you know, his mate Shane Warne, who also offered to come out of retirement on several occasions when Australia was struggling. All right, are we going to do some honourable mentions here?
Well, let's whip through a few of them. I think we've expanded a few of our nominations to incorporate a few of the things that sort of woolly edges, but there's probably a few other things. I've got at least one more.
I think one of the ones that I enjoy, and Adam kind of alluded to this, was and I have mentioned this in the past, I do like the fact that he in his career against England, he won 2 series and lost 5, but also somehow ended up with a 15-13 test record against England thanks to the clean sweep. So that's always tickled me. I think that will never stop tickling me.
That's maybe part of it as well, because he lost more series against England than I knew Australia actually lost in the last 20 years. Like, if you actually sort of tot it up in your head. So he doesn't really sort of fit the sort of successful Australian captain, I suppose. Kind of, I don't know, it's not really a moment, but like, I always remember him as being one of the worst for talking bollocks about the line and where the line is and going up to the line. I feel like he almost started it. He was the one who popularized it, definitely. The Anderson thing in particular, the broken fucking arm, he'd sort of express regret about it, but then he'd almost immediately reframe it as Australians playing hard but fair, and he would just forever just like skirting around what this line was and shuffling it about. And you never quite knew where you stood, but one thing you could be sure was that he was in the right, and someone else was probably in the wrong.
Yeah, and of course we've got all these magnificent off-field antics here. You've got him, as Adam alluded to earlier, him leaving the tour of New Zealand to go deal with whatever his relationship status with Lara Bingle was at the time. And again, as Adam alluded to, as he was trying to return from injury in time for the 2015 World Cup, his farewell to One Day Internationals, he did do a magnificent tweet in which he basically said, "While you sleep, I train." let me get it right. "While you sleep, I train. While you eat, I train. While you party, I train. February 21st is my goal." And that also seemed to sum up Michael Clark. Just this cringeworthy, you know, I'm going to do all these things while you guys are lazing about sleeping, eating and partying.
And you're supposed to recover as well. Training's no good if you don't recover afterwards. So maybe that's where he went wrong.
Yeah, and it was that. It's kind of like in keeping with that Instagram quote world that he sort of to an extent lives in now, doesn't he? I mean, I know it was it's his former wife, isn't it, Kylie, who released a book of Instagram quotes and all versions of that. And that's not, obviously, he can't be held accountable for what his partner publishes. But I'm simply saying that there's a lot of that. If you want to trawl through the social media of Papa, I don't think you'd have to go far to find cliches like that. But then again, that's the same for a lot of professional sports people. So yeah. I don't want to be overly critical of that.
And of course, the other very popular off-field moment was his guest stint in the 2015 Sydney to Hobart yacht race, in which he spent pretty much the entire time being seasick, and then they had to turn around and go back. But he did say, you know, I'd do it again. And he's never done it again. I think that was a one-off.
Not invited, I guess.
Can I say that about Michael Clarke more holistically?
Yep.
Like, this is kind of paraphrasing something I've written in the past, but I think that he was on a bit of a hiding to nothing as Australia's first Gen Y captain as well. Remember that a lot of the Clarke pre-captaincy was around the idea that he was an underwear model. Remember, he was linked with Bonds for a long time. The fact that he would be the first Australian captain, I would imagine, with tattoos, certainly visible tattoos all over his arms and torso and all the rest of it. And, you know, he sort of lived... He's the first Australian captain that sort of was brought up online, I suppose you could go as far to say.
Yep.
There is that generation gap between him and Ponting. There's probably the better part of 10 years between the two of them. Maybe not quite 10, but I suppose you can get what I'm trying to say here. So he was judged on a pretty harsh curve for a lot of stuff that wasn't really his fault. I suppose anyone who was taking over at that time would have jarred in a similar way. And I think that towards the end, and I'm sorry for being earnest here, I can't help it. I feel like I should give some balance after we've been saying some unpleasant things. I think towards the end as well, we talked about 2015. It shouldn't be underestimated ever when talking about Clarke, the grief, the repressed grief that he experienced through 14-15. I can't fathom what it would be like having someone as close to me as he was to Phil Hughes die in the workplace that you are, you know, where he was desperately trying to get to the SCG. It happened. He's written about those few days in his life. He did an extraordinary job to speak on behalf of the team and Australian cricket more generally through that torrid fortnight, his closeness with the family and all the rest of it. And he had a job to do through that, and he did it admirably. And I think it did take a toll on the final, final 9 months of his professional career, Australian career. I think that we all got on with it. By it, I mean the game very quickly. Within 3 weeks of Hughes dying, they were back playing a test match, and that extraordinary 100 that he made with shredded hamstrings and a back that was no longer working. And yes, that cost him the next 3 months of his career, and he came back just in time for the World Cup. But yeah, I don't think that because of that, when you sleep, I train, when you this, I train, that was all through that exact period.
Yes.
So he threw himself so heavily into getting back for the World Cup, as heavily into the game, that it clearly took him a while to decompress and then grieve and then almost fall apart. So yeah, I think there are a few bits to Clarke that, you know, when you put it all into the stew and mix it up together, there's the Kadich bit, there's the Lara Bingle bit, there's all the bits we can take the piss out of. But there were some quite acute moments in his life that I think that we perhaps didn't quite give as much credence to at the time, because we principally saw him as a batsman and as the captain of Australia more than as a human being. So again, I'm sorry to go all earnest at the end, but I thought I should balance out a bit of what we've said.
No, that's certainly fair enough. He's definitely a fascinating character, which was why we kind of made him the target, if you like, of this particular podcast. We're trying to work him out.
Yep.
So let's work out the three most ridiculous moments of Michael Clarke's career. What have you got here, Alex? What do you think?
Well, I don't know. I mean, it depends how you frame them. Like,
yep.
I still the first thing I think about is your teammate grabbing you by the throat. That's to just have a tonal shift again immediately. But then if like his batting for that period around 2012 was incredible. I mean, what was our nomination on that? How did we actually frame it?
I started with Clarke's century against South Africa in 2011, and then I just kind of just said all the other ridiculous runs he scored as well.
Yeah, well, you see, if it's just that, that's kind of ridiculous. But I think the ridiculousness to me is doing all that and then Australians kind of thinking, oh, it's great at the time, but then we're not really going to think about it much afterwards. That to me that's the most ridiculous thing to me. To be that good and for people to not shrug it off, but not really cling to it and celebrate it in the way that they might do.
Yeah, I think on field... it's the purple patch in terms of like a ridiculous stretch of time. 30 tests is a long window over nearly 3 years when he was the best player in the world. So there's the on-field bit. And then off the field, there is just so much stuff, isn't there? there's just so much stuff with Clarke. I mean, you know what? I don't know whether he's a particularly good bloke or not. I don't know whether it's easy to, and more to the point, I don't think it matters a great deal either. You're allowed to be an exceptional sportsman without being a nice person. That's permitted. You can be both at the same time. In fact, one might help the other. Not being particularly emotionally engaged might help you be a prolific batsman. I don't know. But there are so many bits off the field. I feel like you're better placed to assess which should sit there. But as far as the on-field stuff, that bit speaks for itself, I think.
Yeah, all right. So we're going to put that at number one. I think in terms of ridiculous off-the-field moments, it's pretty hard to go past the I seen Alastair Cook bit, isn't it?
It seems to, like, what I like about it is it seems to sum up like an unexpected part of his character. He comes across as quite earnest a lot of the time. And then there was the handshake thing as well. Remember the weird handshake? Well, the non-handshake. I don't even know what was going on there because I hadn't seen footage of it, but just him doing that like dancing handshake and Alistair Cook standing there like the most po-faced man in the universe. That's just a great moment. But that's like, he would just like throw that in every now and again. And I remember him do, and this is a weird one, I remember him doing a signal for a third umpire review in the most sort of elaborate over the top, I think it's when it first came in, like getting down on one knee and I don't want to use the word fisting exactly, but like fisting his own forearm in this over the top fashion. And he would just do stuff like that. And I feel like the IC Alistair Cook was like a pure example of that, where this like earnest Australia captain, very committed to his cricket, and the sort of self-improvement type quotes as well. And he had that side to him as well, which I found quite unexpected. And I think it sums that up pretty well.
Yeah. All right. And then the final one, to me, I think it's either the zillions of feuds, or it's him throwing the ball at Shane Watson, which I honestly watch this regularly. It never fails to make me laugh. So I'll leave that to you two to decide which you think is the more ridiculous.
I suppose the throwing of the ball, at Shane Watson, almost like as I watch that, I think, oh, this is why people sometimes fall out with Michael Clarke.
Yep.
And then the rest of it stems from that.
Yep.
I think bowling is worth mentioning though as well. Sorry, just to sort of throw that in the mix as well, because those two spells against India were just the weirdest out of the blue.
Yeah,
like,
that's
they're,
true.
They're pretty weird. They're pretty ridiculous. To just come on, start bowling and have 6 for 9, and then to just be a bowler, like a part-time bowler in your second over, and just win a test match with 3 wickets. That's pretty weird as well.
Yeah, that's true. Do you have any thoughts, Adam? We'll let you do the casting vote. What's the third most ridiculous thing that Michael Clarke's ever done?
Oh, God, I think they're both very good candidates. I think I might trend towards the feuds only because they continue to generate more ridiculous conversation. If that's the theme of the podcast, the fact that even to this day, it remains a talking point. What is it?
Well, yeah, they're still burning away, aren't they? Still smouldering, some of those.
Yeah, it truly is. That is still very much part. It's folklore, isn't it? And to contribute to folklore is more of a, perhaps more of a lasting legacy than to contribute to the wickets column, even in a couple of very famous test matches.
All right. So I think that wraps it up. So we've got the top three moments of Michael Clarke's career. We've got his batting, we've got his I seen Alastair Cook, and then we've got all the feuds. They're the three most ridiculous moments of Michael Clarke's career. And that will wrap it up for our coverage of not just this podcast, but our entire coverage of the 2013-14 Ashes. Thank you for listening. Massive thanks to Adam for offering his insight into the ridiculousness of Michael Clarke and, you know, some of the less ridiculous aspects of him.
Yes. Again, I'm sorry for being a bit serious there at different times. I just sort of feel this. I feel this like guilt about Clarke. Is that the right word? It's guilt because I was a cunt about Clarke so often. And I know that in my heart of hearts that I've said and I've written some really unpleasant things about him. And it took years for me to realize that a lot of it was kind of almost telling on myself about having a lot of similar traits to him. And here we are years later and I still can't quite reconcile it. So nice to do some group therapy with the two.
That's good. Is there anything you want to plug, Adam? Any podcast that you do?
I usually have stuff to plug. If you're not a listener to the Final Week Cricket Podcast, we make that twice a week, Jeff Lemon and myself. You can find that in all the usual places. That would be the place to go. And we're going to make them every day of the England-India Test Series, both on YouTube and on our podcast feed. So you can see Jeff and me on camera, if that's your preferred way of consuming what we do. But yes, the podcast is it's lots of fun at the moment. So join the party.
Yes, definitely highly recommended. Also highly recommended, Alex's website. That's kingcricket.co.uk.
Yes, I agree. I've often said, sorry to jump in, I've been saying for years, I reckon you could Twitter search me back as far as, I don't know, 2010, saying that Alex is my favourite cricket writer in the world, and he remains my favourite cricket writer in the world. I've been such a long-term subscriber to King Cricket that there are very few things I read religiously when they land in my inbox, but your emails are one, and keep up your extraordinary work.
This never fails to make me feel uncomfortable.
then we'll also ask you to, we'll move on from Alex being uncomfortable. We'll ask you to check out my website. That's leibcricket.com. You can follow us on Twitter. We're at Ridiculous Ashes. We're at The King's Tweets. We're at Leib Cricket. And Adam, you are at?
Collins Adam.
And we'll speak to you next time. Bye.
Social Podcast Network.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry, we were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right, ChumbaCasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.